You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 21st, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
What up?
Kara is still at class or something tonight. She's going to be joining us a little bit later. She says she's really getting crushed this semester in her PhD studies.
That'll do it.
But she's still going to make time for us, just going to be joining us a little late.
So, Steve, how's the house drying out?
It's terrible.
What's the latest?
Oh, my God.
Well, we've had fans and dehumidifiers running 24 hours a day for the last week. And then a couple days ago, they started the destruction phase. They basically gutted our kitchen.
Yep. You got to take pictures, man. Take pictures. I want to see this.
Yeah. It's like half the floor is ripped off.
Take pictures? Come on.
The wall is torn down. You know, we don't have a sink. We don't have access to our kitchen, basically. It's terrible.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's
and then all the shit they took out of the kitchen, they put in our family room, so we don't really have access to that room either.
Oh, my God.
It's a little inconvenient.
Yeah, you probably lost, what, 33% of your house through all of this? One way or the other?
It's terrible. Like, you know, think about it. You know, what you use your home for, the kitchen is like the core functionality of your house, right?
Oh, yes.
It's where most of the stuff happens. I mean, if your bedroom is out of commission, hey, sleep on a couch, you know. Your kitchen's out of commission. You can't use your house.
I think you're right. In an odd way, like it's, you know, 85, 90% of my time is in the kitchen and most of it is cooking and cleaning. I just realized that my life is mostly cooking and cleaning.
Well, there's something to be said for that.
Oh my God, my son.
Especially keeping clean.
It's because of my son. You make something and he wants something else. And now we just told him, nope, that's it. If you don't like what we made for dinner, you're going to bed hungry. And you know what happened? He did it like once and then he eats whatever we make for dinner now.
Right. It's like what Data said to his cat Spot once. He says, perhaps hunger will compel you to try it.
Steve, what's the update on SGU Studio? It's dry?
It's dry and in complete disarray.
All right, I will be there tomorrow to put it all back together.
I need a couple hours down there to get it back together.
Well, don't kid yourself. We got to figure out what got totaled, you know, because we haven't even turned anything on yet. So we just want everything to have like a good week to dry out. Now I get to get down there and see what the hell is really going on.
Yeah.
Get those electrons flowing.
Yep.
Speaking of disasters.
Yeah, Evan.
What happened?
I can't really call it a disaster because it was actually quite a memorable night I had with my daughter in New York City. I took my daughter to go see a concert in New York City this past weekend. The name of the band is called August Burns Red. This is a metalcore band. So for lack of a better term, it's heavy metal, but it's a lot of low growling and grunting, sort of that really angry sounding music. Very intense.
This is what your daughter's into these days?
This is what she's into these days. I know you guys haven't spoken to her lately, but she's, you know, developed quite a new taste in music in just the last few months. Yes. So I got the bright idea to take her to this. So we go. This is this past Saturday night in New York City. We have a plan. Okay. We go in with a plan. We're like, all right, because we watched footage, you know, online of what these concerts are like. And of course, there's mosh pits and there's people body surfing all over the crowd and stuff. And these are very intense, intense concerts. We have a plan. Okay. When we get inside, we're going to stick sort of to the outside, kind of close to the doors, close to the exits. We don't get really near the melee. We're just going to, and maybe towards the back as well. That way, you know, we can escape easily in case things go sour or bad or whatever. Okay. That's our plan going in. We get there, 5:00. Rachel, let's go have some dinner. Nope. She wants to stand in line with the other people in line who have already waiting. And this is out in the snow in New York City. So we wait in line for just about 2 hours to get in. All right, fine. We did that. We get inside. They're letting people in. All right, Rachel, remember the plan, right? Okay. What does she do? She gets into the auditorium, the general admission area, goes right to the front. Front and center, right up against the iron metal barrier that is right between where the crowd ends and the stage begins. So much for our plan of staying to the outside and away from it all. The plan, total bust. So she's up there. She's thrilled. And the band start, you know, and the bands all start and they're playing and it's getting crazier and crazier as sort of the night progresses with each of these groups as they come on. My job was to protect Rachel by bracing myself up against the barrier with two arms, and she's kind of between my two arms in front of me, and I have the weight of the whole crowd, 2,000 people behind me, pressing up against me, shoving me left, right, forward, and every which way. At the same time, there are stage, these are these body surfers, these people who ride the crowd, you know, and they're coming over the top of us and landing down in front of us. And when you are center of these crowds and stuff, you're taking basically the brunt of it. Legs are swinging, you're getting kicked in the head and everything else. She's having she's having a grand old time as I'm protecting her. I'm taking this beating like I've not taken a beating in a long time. Well, by the end of August Burns Red was the last act. They come on. This is about 2.5 hours into the show. We've been on our feet now for like 5 hours, going into our 6 hours of standing up. I'm exhausted, physically exhausted. I start to get lightheaded. You know that sensation you get when, I don't know if you guys have ever come close to passing out or had that sensation, yeah. Like you know you're ready to go down. Well, I got it. And there was still about 20, 30 minutes left in the concert. I'm like, and I said, Rachel, we got to go because I'm about to pass out. I'm literally going to fall down and go unconscious right now. And she just looks at me and she says, Dad, you go, I'm staying. I don't know what came over me, but I decided, okay, I'm just going to let her stay and she's just going to have to, you know, take her chances.
For herself, yeah.
I barely, and I mean barely, got out of there. I would have fallen down if it wasn't so packed so tightly that I was kind of bouncing off of people as I was making my way outside, where I finally got a chance to get down to the floor. I didn't pass out, grabbed a bottle of water, and I sort of, you know, prevented myself from absolutely falling unconscious, hitting my head and who knows what else. Long story short is that Rachel was in there. She enjoyed the end of the show. You know, she had a little interaction even with the band. They gave her a drumstick. They, you know, were cool. Smiling at her. She got to meet the drummer and stuff. So she had an absolute blast and I almost died. So that was my adventure this past weekend, going to the metalcore concert with Rachel.
Damn.
Oh my God, Evan.
I survived though.
Man, talk about two people having a completely different night that were within 3 feet of each other. Like, oh my God.
Yep. I mean, Rachel took a couple glances to the head. Nothing too bad. But you know, she was absolutely thrilled and loved it. And she wants to go back for more. And I have to figure out if I'm capable of going back for more someday, but we'll see.
You have to get her into a different genre of music.
Well, she likes several genres. She just happens to be particular about this one right now is what is grabbing her interest, but she does like lots of different genres of music, and thank goodness for that, because I don't think I could survive this being sort of a, you know, all through her teens just going to these right. sorts of shows. So thank you for letting me vent that. I felt it
you have to
important.
Make a deal with her. You concerts where you can sit down. There have to be seats.
Yeah. I think going forward, that'll probably
that's a good rule.
Be the
way. I took Julia and her friends to. Well, it helps. I took the girls and their friends to a Muse concert last summer. Which, you guys familiar with Muse? They're a British sort of heavy metal band, but very good. Actually, I actually like their music a lot. That was a great concert. I was quite comfortable sitting in my chair the whole time. That's the way to see a concert, not being crushed up against an iron grate standing up for 6 hours.
Oh, my gosh. And if anyone wants to see footage of the show, just go to YouTube, type in August Burns Red, Irving Plaza, New York City. You'll see the footage from February 17th. I don't know that you can make me out in the front, you know, from what you see, but you'll get the sense of how crowded and how insane it was and what a real atmosphere it just was.
It's funny, Liz and I had the kind of a medium experience. We saw Noel Gallagher in Boston and he's fantastic, and there were seats, but we didn't sit down. Nobody sat down for a couple hours, but it was fun. He's good, man. He's really good.
Oasis fame, right?
Yes.
The worst concert I went to from like the crowd perspective was a Lollapalooza concert. Yes, I know what that feels like, Evan, when you're in a hostel, like your body is being physically moved, like the tide is pulling you type of thing.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't get out. And I remember I was like trying to help this girl get out of the crowd because she was getting crushed and I wasn't. And I was like the way that she was going to survive. But conversely, the absolute friendliest concert I ever went to was a reggae concert on Martha's Vineyard. It was just as crowded. I had to go to the bathroom, and I literally walked straight in a straight line in the direction I wanted to go to, and the crowd moved around me like water. You know what I mean? Like they were not. Water. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. I remember like it occurred to me like I literally didn't touch one person. Everyone's dancing and, you know, just as crowded and crazy, but there was no aggression, I guess. I don't know. So.
And it's not like there were bad people at the concert, you know, being jerks and everything. It's just what it is. That it's just the genre. And actually people were quite nice. We were speaking to them and having nice conversations between the sets. And nobody was being disrespectful or too unruly. Or but when the music gets started, that's it. People just
it's like
go
festival
into their frenzy.
They go crazy.
Festival.
They just go crazy. I saw those kids. My God.
All right, gosh. Bob, get us started with Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Yes, for this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science, I'm going to talk about Oscar Michaud, 1884 to 1951. He was the first mainstream black movie maker. He wrote, directed, and produced 44 films starting a century ago. As a pioneer, I can't help but think he helped lay the groundwork for the phenomenal success of movies like Black Panther, which you should see.
Oh,
it's a
hello.
Ton of fun. And I wanted to cover Oscar this week, partly in homage to the incredible success of Black Panther, directed by Ryan Coogler. It really is breaking all records. Second best 4-day opening of all time with almost a quarter of a billion. The best Monday ever. Best Monday ever at the domestic box office and wow. Record after record. So I can't help but think that Oscar actually had a hand in some of this in some way. So Michaud was a pioneering author and filmmaker. 1919, he created his own movie production company, the Lincoln Motion Picture Company, and he's considered the first major African-American feature filmmaker. He wrote and produced and directed an impressive 44 films. Think about that. I mean, people do that to this day, but it's not that common anymore. Wrote, produced, and directed. And 44 films, that's just almost unheard of, I think. Like The Homesteader in 1919 and a sound feature-length film, The Exile, in 1931. And he successfully made the transition from silent movies to sound talkies. Which I don't think was incredibly common. I mean, that's a tough transition. And to top it off, he also wrote 7 novels, one of which was a national bestseller. So an amazing guy. Look him up. Maybe some of his movies are online. Some of them have survived. So remember Oscar Michaud. Watch his movies. Mention him to your friends. Perhaps when discussing block booking, the 180-degree rule, or perhaps non-diegetic sound.
Diegetic? Non-diegetic
yes.
sound.
Yes, okay. that is sound that really wouldn't be on the scene if you were there, like, say, the music or a voiceover. That's non-diegetic sound. Mm-hmm. Diegetic cool. sound would be people speaking or cars crashing. That's kind of what you would expect to hear if you were actually there.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Why don't you just say
Jay,
that?
Jay and I are familiar with the 180-degree rule because we broke it.
I figured you would be.
Relentlessly yep. in our first videos until somebody pointed it out. We weren't supposed to do that.
Don't cross the line. Yep.
I think Craig Good taught us about the 180-degree rule. We're like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
And Phil Hudson.
If you're flipping the camera angle between like two people having a conversation, the camera should never go beyond 180 degrees. Otherwise, the audience gets confused about the relative position of the two people. Unless, of course, you're Stanley Kubrick and you deliberately right. break the rule in The Shining in order yes. to suggest that these two characters are linked in some kind of mystical way. All right. Got to know the rules before you can break the rules. We didn't know
yes,
the rules. Now
good
we do.
Point.
Right. All right. Jay, tell yeah. us about Elon Musk's now he has a plan for satellite broadband. What's this guy doing now? What's he
Gosh,
up to?
He's Come busy. On.
Well, I love finding out, like, all of a sudden, you know, hey, Elon Musk's SpaceX is developing a system of satellites that's going to provide the world with broadband. You know, like, what else is this guy doing nice. That we don't know about? You know, so the more I learn about Elon and SpaceX, just the more I love and love and love this company. SpaceX is, like I said, now trying to compete with the biggest telecom companies in the world. They're going to launch thousands of satellites that will provide broadband globally, and it's called Starlink.
Thousands?
Yep. As we record this show, the Falcon 9 rocket is likely to launch tomorrow, February 22nd, 2018, and it's carrying 2 test satellites, among other things. It's carrying 2 test satellites that are the very beginning of the Starlink project. The satellites are called MicroSat 2A and MicroSat 2B. So
oh,
once Starlink, Yeah, they're small. They only weigh about 900 pounds.
Relatively small.
That is actually very small for a satellite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want a nanosat.
Once Starlink is fully deployed, it'll have upwards of 10,000 low-orbit satellites delivering 5G broadband globally. So let me give you the details.
Wow.
So other companies have tried to do this similar type of thing, and other companies are currently trying to do something similar as well. But SpaceX seems far and away the leader in this. You know, they're calling it a new industry, even though like there's been attempts for, I think, well over a decade, and big companies that are trying. But SpaceX is launching and saying that they're going to have phase one completed in 2019. As reported by the FCC, there are about 15.2 million Americans that don't have any broadband service. This includes basic internet and mobile. And that's horrible. Could you imagine, you know, you're in the Midwest somewhere or, you know, on land that just doesn't have any coverage at all, and the companies are not wiring internet to you either. You just don't have any ability to get on the internet. I think if it's priced right, SpaceX is sitting on its most lucrative venture by far. And I think this one is it.
Really?
Yep.
And yeah, so it's going to be 5G everywhere, just blanketing the planet.
Yeah, but by the time they get up there, why not just shoot for the stars and say, oh, yeah, like 7G. I mean, 5G is going to be a thing of the past by the time there's 1,000 satellites.
Well, that's Bob, going to take. Bob, they're, like they're, to they it. Told you, man, phase one, 2019. Now, largely that SpaceX is intending their initial audience to be these 15.2 million Americans that don't have access. And then they were also saying that they could cover about 10%, I think, of the total internet traffic. And they would be focusing that on cities that are overcrowded. And if you, like, let's say you live in New York City, and because of how crowded it is and how used the broadband is, you just don't get access. Well, they're providing further access to the internet so you can get off of one of the main companies. So the detailed plans are this. SpaceX will launch 4,425 satellites in 2019. The system is said to be able to start functioning with as little as 800 satellites in orbit, and they will be around 700 miles above the Earth. That's considered a low Earth orbit.
Yeah.
According to the FCC, Starlink is going to be able to offer broadband speeds similar to fiber optic networks. Now, I know that 5G is not that claim, but I did read that, and that's what they're saying. And I did some calculations, and this could be somewhere in the range of 1,000 megabits per second, where I'm getting right now about 100 megabits per second with my super expensive pay-through-the-nose internet connection by one of the companies that you know I hate. So I'm not crystal clear. When they say 5G, that might be the limit on mobile, and maybe if it's to your PC, it could be much more than that. It could be on the fiber optic level. I don't know, but that's what is being said by the FCC.
What about upload?
According to the information I read, it's going to be infinitely better than, say, a dish, you know, that you would have on your house.
Well, I wouldn't say infinite.
For the sake of this, it's going to be, you know, as good as what you get with a wired connection. From what they're saying. I mean, think about it. They're saying that it's going to be, you know, fiber optic styled connectivity. So who knows? Elon said that Starlink could provide 5G-like service to billions of people globally. He said it could also help provide internet, like I said, to those in congested areas. But mostly what he's saying is this is going to be wonderful for people who live in poor regions around the world. And this could be giving a lot of people their first internet connectivity ever.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's wonderful. I mean, this guy, you know, I haven't read anything negative about Elon yet. I mean, I've read people with negative interpretations of things or whatever, but he seems like someone that really cares and someone that's trying to incite a lot of growth in technology. As I said, with the Falcon 9 Heavy, he's telling other companies, join me, compete with me. Let's do it. Let's make this an industry. Let's move forward. So I bet you that very similarly, he's doing that here. So they also said there'll be 20 months of testing. These 900-pound satellites along. Now, this is how it works. They're going to have the 900-pound satellites. The first two are going up. Then they're going to continue to make more launches. Then there's going to be 6 fixed position stations on Earth and 3 mobile stations across the U.S. And I guess these mobile stations are going to be in vans. And I don't know why they need to be mobile. I couldn't find any details about that. Now, I found out something else I love about this circumstance. Google's parent company, Alphabet, has invested $1 billion in this venture.
What?
I like that.
Yep.
I like that.
Whoa.
How's that for an investment? I can't tell you guys how happy it makes me to see, you know, would you still call SpaceX a relatively new company? It's new-ish. I can't tell you how awesome it is to have them go head-to-head with these billion-dollar companies that are, without getting into the whole net neutrality situation, this is only what I would consider to be something good for the open market. So, man, Elon Musk is really kicking ass over here. But I think really, if he does price this correctly, if he doesn't come out with it being too expensive, if it's affordable and the service is good, I would very happily abandon paying one of these other companies that have done nothing but take my money and not improve the infrastructure. And if they have, I haven't seen any difference. All I see is that they keep trying to raise the price of my service that I'm paying. So I bid SpaceX huge good fortune in this venture. Man, I really hope that they just kill it. I hope that this thing works exactly the way that they planned and they roll it out in the next couple of years. And you could just be on your mobile device and just pick what company you want to provide your service from.
Yeah, I think we totally need to completely disconnect devices from providers. You know what I mean?
Yep.
You should get whatever device you want and use it with any service you want. And they should just be competing on quality and price.
Yep.
Yeah, and this kind of system is good because there isn't this like, oh, who's paying for the last mile of cable? You know what I mean? There's no cable. It's all in the airwaves, you know?
Yeah, and other interesting things, like, you know, you go to a foreign country, maybe you don't have to buy a local burner anymore, you know, or pay your company a whole ton of money just so you could be in Europe.
Yeah, global service.
Yep.
That would be awesome.
And full coverage, Steve. Full coverage.
You full know what coverage.
I mean? Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. You could be standing on a mountaintop and have cell service.
And this will be some people's first broadband experience or even internet experience. Mine was what? A 7200 baud funky thing that sounded like a broken fax machine and 6 minutes to download a picture. Oh, man.
There was something very fun and romantic about those times. I mean, of course, we could never go back, but it was really cool, you know, watching the internet come alive in those days and
oh, God, yeah.
Seeing steady increases in processor power and, you know, the speed of
constant,
your connectivity.
Yeah.
And then switching from like the pre-smartphone to the smartphone. My God, that was amazing.
Wow.
What a leap. Ooh. Good luck, man. I just hope this thing comes out swinging as soon as they start doing it.
All right, guys, have you ever heard of Super Brain Yoga?
No. Is it hot, like hot yoga? What do you do?
No, it's even dumber.
Sounds like a food, superfood.
I may have spoken about this before, but I wrote an updated article about it because someone left a comment on my article about it on Neurologica from 2015. And he said, oh, you should research a topic before you call it a hoax. And then he provided four links to studies from 2016 and 2017. Okay. See the problem there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You should have known in the future.
Yes. No, you didn't account for these studies that came out after you wrote your article. So anyway, I'm like, okay, fine. This guy's pointing to evidence. I'm sure this is crap, but let's take a look and see how much crap that they are. So first of all, Super Brain Yoga, what is it? This is pure pseudoscience. This is magic. This isn't even, you know, like physical therapy or chiropractic nonsense. I'm not saying that all physical therapy is nonsense. What I'm saying is this isn't like where something is actually physically happening, but you're just making claims that go beyond, you know, the exercise or whatever is happening. This is like real magic. So this is what you have to do. This is being marketed in parenting magazines and to schools. And this is a way it's supposed to wake up your brain and energize your brain and make you smarter and all more alert, more attentive. So first thing you do is connect your tongue to your palate, right? You guys could all do this while I describe it. You tell me if you feel energized. Then you have to face east. That's very important. You have to face east. The left arm must be inside and the right arm must be outside. So you cross your arms over each other, left under right. Inhale while squatting down and then exhale while standing up. Your thumb should be touching the front part of your earlobes, index fingers behind the earlobes. And do that 14 to 21 times once or twice a day.
This is a prank.
Yeah,
this
you would think so, right? It is. It looks like an Onion article, right? Like this, you would prank somebody to get him to do this, and you'd laugh at how stupid they are.
Oh my gosh!
But this is serious, you know. The claims are people are really making these claims. This is not a prank. This was, you know, just made up by some guy, you know, who is just, you know, this is his brand of Eastern mysticism. he says, oh, there are subtle energies in the body, and this is going to connect the chakras in your forehead to your crown chakra, you know, and the energy is going to flow. It's just pure, you know, life force, magical energy. So this was invented by Choa Kok Sui, mm-hmm. who's a self-proclaimed grandmaster of something. He wrote a book about it. And yeah, that's it. Just made up his own pseudoscience. And then I guess, but I don't know why the word yoga is attached to it. I guess because yoga right. is kind of a popular brand. So this is super brain yoga. And then, you know, that people look into it. All marketing. So this guy comes in, you know, he obviously claiming that he thinks it works, you know, criticizing me for calling the pseudoscience. So I looked at the studies, wow. and the studies are such a perfect example of pseudoscience. Just wonderful, you know? Like, it exhibit all the features that I talk about for years about what is pseudoscience. So first of all, none of the studies are controlled or blinded, right? They're just uncontrolled. They're just comparing people before and after intervention, but there's no control group. You can pretty much stop right there. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're looking at a subjective outcome and it's uncontrolled and there's no blinding. Everybody knows what's happening. And also, like, you're telling kids to squat 20 times or whatever. You know, first of all, there's a generic pretest post-test effect. If you have anybody do anything twice, they're going to do better on the second time. Right? So this is like, remember all those parlor tricks where, like with the super bands, you know, the rubber bands that make, yeah, they make you stronger. You could turn around, you have increase your flexibility. And yep. Part of that is just like put your arms out to the side. Now rotate around and see how far you could point your fingers. Now I do my magic. Now rotate around again and you could point. Look, you go 20 degrees farther. It works no matter what you do. Cause for whatever reason, people always do better on the second go. That's just the way it is.
Because they want to improve on.
Well, whatever. There's a little bit of a practice effect or a motivational effect. And then there's also other non-specific effects like the Hawthorne effect, right? The observer effect. You're doing an intervention, especially adults doing an intervention with kids, right? The kids are going to want to go along with it and show that it works. And then just physically moving around is going to have a little bit of an alerting effect. You know, you get somebody who's been sitting there. Probably kids are half asleep in class. All right, get up and do 21 squats. Look at this. You're more attentive. You know, that's the magic of prana flowing through your chakras. Uncontrolled studies are of absolutely zero value. You can draw no conclusions from these results, any of them.
Well, I can make conclusions about the quality of the researchers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're all published in these fringe throwaway journals, like really fringe journals. So one was the Indian Journal of Traditional Knowledge. Not exactly JAMA, you know.
Yeah.
In the description, they acknowledge this is a quasi-experimental observation. What does that mean? A quasi-experiment? One that was published in that Indian journal said that they measured the pranic energy in the subjects, and the pranic energy was increased. So I'm like, that's interesting. How did they measure the pranic energy?
With the pranic energy meter.
What is that?
I went to the methods to see their description of how they measured it. And the description in the methods was that they measured it, quote unquote, using a scale.
Wow.
That was it. That was the extent of the description.
Wow. Okay.
Using a convinced. Scale.
They're not even trying.
So I don't even, the thing is that I don't know what they mean. I don't know if it's
harmonic
a translation.
Scale?
Yeah. So like the Richter scale, like, I mean, did they use a scale? Meaning like a way of quantifying something, or like a scale like you step on to weigh yourself, like a device scale or a quantification, a numbering system. Like, I don't even know what they're talking about. And what I wrote about, like, so the thing is, if that's the case, they buried the lead in, you know, in titling this article. The title of the article is not that the super brain yoga, you know, makes kids think that they have more energy. It's that some guy could measure pranic energy. You know, like,
you've just
discovered a new form of energy that actually affects biological creatures. I mean, line up for your Nobel Prize, you know?
Damn right.
Yeah, that's like a scientist like 50 years ago. I detected black hole collisions using gravitational waves. Like, wait, screw black hole collisions. You detected gravitational waves? What are you talking about?
Right. But is it like proving super brain yoga by measuring pranic energy is like using a psychic to communicate to time traveling aliens?
Yeah, that's about right.
That's a good one too, Steve.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
All right, so you know, also these kind of they're small studies. They reek of pee hacking, you know.
They reek of pee hacking. Yep.
Yeah, just you could make anything positive if you want to, you know, if you give yourself enough wiggle room. So the sloppy methodology in these studies is just, you know, is evident. So that's it. Four completely worthless, uncontrolled studies. But they had their actual intended effect, right? The purpose of these studies was not to determine if super brain yoga worked, because they weren't designed to tell if it worked. What they were designed to do was to provide a patina of science-iness to super brain yoga. And that's what they did. And it clearly was enough to convince at least that one commenter, like, look, there's links to published studies. It must be real science, you know?
Oh my gosh. Scary.
Yeah, but they're all utter crap, you know? Now, and if, yes, this is an extreme example of a completely implausible magical system, but it did try to be scientific and try to really cover itself in scientific terminology and everything. That's kind of the point. That's why it's a pseudoscience. But there's a lot, there are many examples of that are just a little bit more subtle, like the claims are not quite as obviously magical and the methodology is not quite so blatantly crap, but they're still equally worthless in terms of you can't make any scientific conclusions from them. They're not really designed to test if the claim is real, if the phenomenon is real. They're designed to show something, to show a positive effect, right? To market, right? This is marketing research, not you know, research about marketing, but research for the purpose of marketing, right? This is just a way of slapping on a veneer of science to this utter nonsense.
Steve, when you wrote this, did you consider the studies published in 2019 and 2020?
No, I have not. I negligently did not read future published studies. So some comment or 2 years from now is really going to let me have it. All right. Hey, joining us now is Kara. Kara, how's your night going? Hey.
I missed you guys.
Yeah, likewise. What's up?
I'm really grumpy because I had this school thing I had to do, and of course it's really far away to meet up with the other people in my cohort. So I've been sitting in traffic for not an hour, but an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah, but isn't that LA? Isn't living in LA mean you're in traffic half your life?
An hour and 45 minutes is really extreme, but that's because I was like close to the beach. I was pretty far away from home, and I came home in rush hour, which, you know, generally you like plan around doing that. It was not fun.
You have to plan your life around traffic. Sounds like fun.
Mm-hmm.
See, flying cars would solve that problem.
Oh, completely. Or jetpacks.
Jetpacks, yeah.
Teleporters.
Jetpacks would be amazing.
Teleporters, yeah.
I know, jetpacks would just be really fun. That's what I want. Just like the fun of flying.
Yeah, Iron Man suits. That's about.
Oh, gosh.
That'd be pretty cool. Just
forget about all that crap. I remember, I have a distinct memory that is, I'm fairly certain, is quite accurate. Yeah. In the house, in the TV room, I must have been 11, and I was saying, and I remember getting so excited, saying something to the effect of, when I get a jetpack, I'm going to fly around the house and stuff. And I remember I got so excited. If I said, Bob, by 2018, you're not going to be anywhere near that happening, I would have been like, no way, and we're still not in. Ugh.
Burst your
40, sorry, 40 years later, and we are no closer to a jetpack. Yeah,
ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean, really,
Bob is outraged. He's outraged.
What's the difference between now and the Dark Ages? Practically nothing.
Poor little 11-year-old Bob. He'd be so bummed, but he didn't know about the internet and all sorts of other cool stuff.
Yeah,
so whatever. Kind of balances out.
It's a wash. Maybe. Yeah, it's a wash.
Maybe.
Yeah,
Bob, think of all the cool video games we have now. Like really violent, gory video games. You get to kill people, blow them up. It's awesome.
That's such a good segue, Steve. I love your sly segues. They're my favorite. So, yes, I am going to talk about, it's sort of a somber topic, but I don't want to spend too much time on the somber part of it. I mean, obviously, we've been in the wake of, like, tragedy here in the United States. The news has rippled across the world, so I know our international listeners know that I'm talking about the Valentine's Day shooting in Florida, where a lot of students and teachers lost their lives. And this is not a new problem here in the United States. And I'm not going to dive deep into the politics of this problem, but what I am going to dive into is an interesting post that was written by a psychologist named Christopher Ferguson, who's a professor at Stetson University. If you guys don't read articles on The Conversation, I highly, highly recommend this website. I know people write to us a lot asking, like, where we get our news. The Conversation is a really good conglomeration of sort of op-ed and blog posts that are written by experts in their field. So it says underneath, kind of the subheading is academic rigor, journalistic flair. So it's you know, it really keeps to journalistic ethical standards, but it's written generally by subject matter experts. So you get a nice deep dive that you don't always get when you're reading science media from journalists. So this piece is called It's Time to End the Debate About Video Games and Violence. And Christopher Ferguson is a psychologist who has been studying the quote unquote link between video games and violence for the last 15 years. And basically the thesis of this piece is there is no link. We cannot find evidence to support the claims that we see over and over in the news media and over on the floor of Congress, honestly, that video games, violent video games lead to violent behavior. We hear this echoed every time there's a mass shooting. Because I get it. People are desperate and they're really upset for good reason. And they want to figure out why this keeps happening. And they want to figure out what we can do to change this. Who can we blame? And one of the most common refrains we hear is the shooter played violent video games. And that is what led them to be armed and to shoot up the school. And so let's maybe break this apart a little bit. Do you still read articles like that constantly when you're kind of flipping through the science literature?
It comes up.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. It still comes up. Yeah. In 2011, there was a Supreme Court case. It was called Brown for our governor here in California, Jerry Brown. Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association et al. And this was a suit kind of saying that children should not be able to play violent video games. And it tried to claim that it could lead to, you know, sort of aberrant or violent behavior. I think it was shot down. Yes, the district court concluded that it violated the First Amendment. It was affirmed in the Ninth Circuit. So children can and do play violent video games. And the reason, not just because it violated the First Amendment, but the reason that this is cited a lot is because when you look to the scientific literature, and that's something that the author of this piece in The Conversation actually did in his own research, he did a meta-analysis, and I'm going to pull that up here, called The Problem of False Positives and False Negatives in Violent Video Game Experiments. And that was actually published in International Journal of Law and Psychiatry quite recently. So what he looked at was different kinds of video game experiments and aggression. And oftentimes the issue when we hear about there being some sort of connection between violent behavior and violent video games, what we're actually talking about is the outcome of studies that are not consistent, that actually look at what's deemed as, quote, aggressive behavior following playing violent video games. And these kinds of things are measured by, like, putting your hands in icy cold water, by, like, serving somebody very hot peppers, like weird metrics of what we might deem aggression. And oftentimes they're socially acceptable versions of quote unquote aggression. And this is something that I've been really interested in lately. This is partially why I picked this topic is A, because I think it's really timely, but B, because in my work, now that I'm back in school and I'm working on my psychology PhD, I'm doing a lot of psychometrics and I'm digging super deep into the idea of like construct validity and content validity and the idea that experiments that we do in psychology are often attempting to quantify human behavior through the use of a defined construct. Because what is aggression really? If we talk about the word aggression, it doesn't have an intrinsic metric the same way that length or height or weight has an intrinsic metric. So psychologists have to actually link the term aggression to something that they can measure. And, you know, the jury is often out on whether or not those are appropriate linkages and whether that construct that is oftentimes invented is actually a valid construct. Needless to say, when you look across all of the literature, I hinted to this, we see that A, sometimes quote unquote aggression is linked to playing violent video games. Sometimes quote unquote aggression is not linked to playing violent video games. We also see that scanning the literature, only positive results tend to be reported. We've talked about this a lot on the show. When there's no link found, that usually doesn't get reported. And lastly, I think one of the biggest problems, and this is an interesting thing that Dr. Ferguson points to in the paper, is that confirmation bias is so heavily at play when we talk about whether or not that school shooter or this school shooter played violent video games. Because the truth of the matter is, almost all juveniles play violent video games. And it's basically the same argument as saying he shot up a school because he wears sneakers. Or he shot up a school because he eats steak. Pringles, yes. It's very, very hard to tease these kinds of things apart in a real world application. And actually, when researchers have come up with sophisticated ways to analyze actual mass shootings and rise and fall in violent video game availability, they've found an inverse relationship. Now, granted, there's no way to know what's happening or if that's even an artifact. Some people have hypothesized that violent video games actually give people who have violent tendencies an outlet so that they don't actually commit violent behaviors. Again, there's really no way to know whether or not that's true. But fundamentally, at its core, if you look at this question scientifically, over and over and over, the data simply aren't there to link violent behavior with, especially this kind of violent behavior that actually leads to physical harm and death, with video games. It's just not there. It's just a non-starter. Yet over and over and over, politicians, journalists, and basically the peanut gallery bring this up time and time again after. And it really has become a scapegoat, I think.
Yeah.
It's a way to not deal with the problem.
I agree. Yeah. I think also it's been extended to kids playing with toy guns.
Mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. And watching violent movies, yeah. watching cartoons.
Violent movies. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Or listening
this debate's been going
music,
on right. since the 70s, since we were kids.
Easily.
Yeah, and it's not like we haven't gathered more data since then. Like, the evidence is there, and the evidence, I'm sorry, is not leaning towards the argument that these people are trying to make.
Yeah.
But yet we still hear it all the time. It's like, oh, yeah, that kid shot up a school. And he was playing violent video games. It's like, yeah, what else was he doing?
Yeah, like every kid.
And he ate drunken noodles the night before.
I know. It's like, yeah, he was playing violent video games. And so was every other kid in that school who didn't shoot up the school that day.
Right.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, it fit into the story very nicely. This idea that video games cause violence and, it's like people are filling in, information after the fact. To make it make more sense. And there is something about it that seems like, of course it would have an effect. I mean, your brain is thinking about these types of actions and, people kind of are what they think type of deal. But
yeah, it seems intuitive, even though it's just not. It's not the case.
I think the inverse is true. in my, this is anecdotal. I'm just going to say my personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
I feel actually like good after if I play a semi-violent or violent video game or, you know, whatever, playing Skyrim as an example, and I get into some fights and stuff. And I feel like I've gotten rid of some pent up frustration and energy.
Mm-hmm.
There's something like of a relief about playing a violent video game, which
I think we need more evidence to see if that actually is the case. But it is, I think it's a totally appropriate hypothesis. I think that it's beginning to be the basis of some of this behavioral research. And also you see it in other areas. And sorry to link these two things because I'm not linking you to this at all, Jay. But there is a lot of research in pedophilia. About computer generated models of things like about utilizing outlets that don't harm anybody to allow individuals to kind of, you know, fantasize or act out these things so that they're not committing crimes. And again, there's a lot of controversy around it. We don't really know ultimately whether it works or not, but it's definitely an area of inquiry that's like a lot of people who work with sex offenders think is an important area of inquiry. So, you know, it's not a dumb thought that being able to like shoot them up in a video game would help you not want to like punch the wall in your house.
I think this is not going to go away in the foreseeable future. I think there's a part of it is there's these kids today phenomenon about it, right? Where it's like, oh, the youth are doing this thing that we didn't do. It's weird. And they're delinquents. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He actually wrote about that, Steve. He said that this is, quote, this echoed historical patterns of moral panic, such as 1950s concerns about comic books and Tipper Gore's efforts to blame pop and rock music in the 1980s for violent sex and Satanism.
Yep.
And in the 80s, it was D&D.
Dungeons and Dragons, big time.
Think about how silly that is today.
Yeah, I've done it all, man. I've done all the bad things.
When we were young guys, when I was college age, when our dad was on the board of education for our town, they were having a conversation about banning Dungeons and Dragons from the school because it was evil. You know?
Oh gosh. Evil.
No, seriously, they didn't know what to make of it. And now in the future, there's going to be all this VR porn or whatever, the VR violence. It's too realistic, you know, and then it's going to be, you know, with robots or whatever. Who knows? Whatever the future technology is, that's going to be they really did it this time. This really is now making them.
Yeah.
Now they've gone
it's
going to
be
far.
The same thing. Yeah.
I agree. Definitely.
All right, Jay, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
Okay, last week I played this noisy. I mean, what is it?
Oh gosh, I have no
anybody?
Idea.
Anybody? Steve, what did you say last week?
You played it louder this time, so I hear more of the background. So if you just focus on the main noise, it sounds a little bit like a frog.
Yeah, like creepers.
Yeah, but if you listen to all of the sound being generated, you could hear that there's other stuff going on there. That now that I know the answer, it kind of makes
there
sense.
There is. Yeah, I think I played a longer clip this time.
Yeah.
So. This is this one was fun because I deliberately picked something that I thought there were multiple answers to. Again, this is really cool. This is like a reoccurring theme in Who's That Noisy. You know, I absolutely hear frogs peeping in that video or in that, you know, that this came from a video, but in that audio clip. And I'll tell you what, let me go through some of the guesses that people made. Someone said it sounds like a prairie chicken. This was Simon Dick. They scratch and make a similar call. Or it could be the call of a pheasant. All right. That was cool. Another person, Jamie Coles said, hey, longtime listener. I guess this is a sound from, Super Mario jumping.
I love how you guys say Mario. It's Mario. So Connecticutian.
Is it Mario?
Mario.
I love it. You guys always say Mario though. And actually it might not even be Connecticutian. It might just be your family. Cause I think you're right.
No,
Evan, you say Mario too.
It's Danbury. It is a
hyper
regional accent. It really, awesome. It is. It is a very tiny, it's a one city accent.
Danbury.
I love that.
Did I Mario. Say Mario or Mario?
You totally said Mario.
Oh, yeah, that's a totally
but
Mario.
Every and other word too. We say is correct.
No, I think it's fun to like hear those quirks, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I just think it's fun when people have like quirks of speech. Yeah,
yeah. Regional accents are very interesting. Mm-hmm. And without getting into too much detail about that, we think that our sister has like a super heavy Danbury, Connecticut accent.
The worst was our cousin.
Oh God, yeah.
Remember her?
One of our cousins.
My mother's name is Pat. We always used to make fun of her saying Aunt Pat.
Pat.
Like it was really extreme.
Aunt Pat. P-E-A-Y-T.
Pat.
Yeah.
I love it.
All right. So to continue, David Barrett guessed, and many people guessed Star Wars blaster noise, you know, but he actually said this was a taut wire vibrating, you know, like a fencing, a wire from a fence vibrating. That's in there. Another listener guessed a baby alligator calling to its mother after a rainstorm. I thought that was, you know, very descriptive and interesting. And I could see, I think I've heard baby alligators making a peeping kind of noise. And then Dan Lee said, sounds like springs or wires slapping the ground in the distance. But then he said, because you said it was a natural sound, he thinks it's a chipmunk.
Mm-hmm.
I like the variability. I like the fact that nobody guessed it right, or almost nobody guessed it right. Actually, a couple of people did guess it right. I was trying to sweep the world, and I lost this week. But anyway, the winner for this week, Phil Ohl, said, my first thought for this week's noisy was the same frog sound that Steve mentioned. Awesome. But then it occurred to me it is probably the sound of Nordic wild ice skating. Yes, Phil, you are correct. This is somebody that's skating on a black ice pond, a very, very freshly frozen pond. They wait until the ice gets to, you know, just the right thickness, and if the conditions have to be right, but the ice is, you know, I don't want to say perfectly smooth, but it doesn't have that windswept look to it. It looks black. And in this video that a lot of people actually did see and wrote me in, to be honest, I did actually, you know, this was probably the worst one I ever did because more people guessed it right than anything else. But it doesn't matter. I really enjoy it when people get excited, and a lot of people wrote in and said, oh my God, I knew what it was. And, you know, they were like talking about, you know, what they thought about it, which is a lot of fun for me. The bottom line is that this video clip that I got this from had so many different sounds in it from this one activity. It depended on how far away the microphone was. It depended on how aggressively the skater was skating. And there was a lot of noise happening, or effects on the noise depending on the surrounding area. So if the guy was closer to the shore, I noticed that the sound changed versus if he was on like deep water. Wonderful. A wonderful sound. Really interesting. And it does sound like a mammal or some type of creature or a frog is making the noise, but it isn't. It's just a guy ice skating. There's lots of details about this style of skate and all that. And of course, it's dangerous. You shouldn't skate on thin ice, of course, but that's what they're doing. And it's kind of pretty to see the video as well. So I suggest that you look it up. That was great. Thank you, Brian Jackson, for sending in that noisy. I really enjoyed it. And just so you know, the sound that we're hearing is coming from the flexing and cracking of the thin layer of ice that's supported by the water, of course, right? So that ice is bowing a little bit as the skater puts their bodily pressure on the ice and pushes. The ice is the shape of the ice is changing, and that noise is vibrating through the water and just makes this wonderful round kind of earthy noise the way I hear it. So thank you, Brian, for sending that in. So this week's noisy was sent in by a listener named Michael Toe Pepper. I don't know.
Meat leg.
Yeah. What is meat leg? Is that somebody who wrote to us once?
Yes. His name was, or I call him Meatle G.
Meatle
G. It literally was spelled meat leg. And I think we emailed the guy. He knows that we bring it up every once in a while. But my nickname for him was Meatle G.
Meat leg. That's the greatest name ever.
That's what we said at the time.
Oh my gosh. I was getting ready this morning, and sorry to interrupt you, and my boyfriend was listens to super weird music, like super bizarre, like usually super heavy music, and he was listening to something that sounded like Kenny G. It was very off and wrong, and I was like, what is this? And he was like, oh, it's a band called Mammal Hands. Mammal Hands is the funniest band name I've ever heard.
Mr. Balloon Hands.
And I feel like Meat Leg and the Mammal Hands would be kind of an amazing band. Go on.
All right, so I got to do this. Hey, Meat Leg, or Meetle G, if you're out there and yeah. you're still listening, email us at info@theskepticsguide.org. I just got to say hi to you. So if you're there, email us. All right, this week's noisy. Could be anything.
Yeah,
if that is true.
If you have a guess, and please, if you have any awesome noisies, send them to me. Talk to me, people. I'll email you back if you send me something good to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. Hey, we got a Name That Logical Fallacy. We haven't had one of those in a while. You guys ready for this? This one comes from Rohnert Park, California. A guy named Bill. Bill says... Dearest to you, a friend of mine has been posting logical fallacies on his Facebook page that are coming from something called the Master List of Logical Fallacies. One of the entries lists excluded middle as, I'm paraphrasing, if a little is good, a lot must be better. I immediately thought this was wrong. The excluded middle is the false dichotomy, but it occurred to me that I couldn't name the fallacy in question, and it seems so clearly useful. It must be a category of logical fallacy. Thoughts? He says, oh, and watch Star Trek Continues. Thanks, as always, and keep fighting the good fight. We have watched Star Trek Continues. Maybe we should review that on Alpha Quadrant 6 at some point.
Mm. Maybe we should go in the past and review them and upload each episode.
Yeah, we'll get Joel on next time he's local. So let's first talk about the excluded middle. What is that? So we're talking about the informal logical fallacies. These are errors in logic and thinking that people commonly make. You know, there's a number of them that are described to just as a guideline, right? About how to avoid making these sloppy thinking mistakes. But they're informal, so they're a little wishy-washy, right? They're not strictly logical fallacies. They're very context dependent. It depends on how you use them. But there are kinds of mistakes that people make. So the excluded middle, I agree, that is the false dichotomy. You're basically saying it's either A or it's B. You know, there's nothing in between. That's the excluded middle. But there's different manifestations that the false dichotomy could take. It could be that you're taking two ends of an extreme and dealing with them as discrete entities. It's like everybody's either tall or short, you know, or... Mm-hmm. And sometimes we do this on purpose for the purpose of categorization. Like we have planets and dwarf planets in our solar system, and there's nothing in between. Then poor little Pluto could kind of go either way. You know what I mean? And it's arbitrary, but we have to decide where to draw the line somewhere. But reality isn't categorized like that. In reality, there's a whole bunch of different kinds of things orbiting our sun. But what about if a little is good, a lot must be better? That I agree that's not the excluded middle, but what logical fallacy do you think that is?
I always have to Google a list of logical fallacies this game.
You could look at our list of logical fallacies.
That would help.
We have a list of logical fallacies?
Well, we have on our website the top 20 logical fallacies, and then in our book, which you guys all have a copy of, even more exhaustive list of the informal logical fallacies.
Is this, can I get a hint, is this in the top 20 that are on the website?
I forget if it's on that list or...
Oh, crap.
False continuum? No.
Yeah, is that a false continuum?
No.
That's sort of like, yeah, the fuzzy line between cults and religion, so they're really the same thing.
So, the one I'm thinking of is actually not in our top 20 list.
You tricked me. All right.
But that's a hint, so it's one that's not
here. That is a hint.
Oh, that makes it way easier. Is it like a faulty generalization?
Yeah, I think it's a hasty generalization.
Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah.
Because
nice find.
It's right? A bad premise.
I think it's basically a non sequitur. You know, I don't think it really is its own logical fallacy, but it's the closest to what they're saying there, I think, is the hasty generalization. You're saying, all right, so this is good, therefore it's always good, and more is even better, right? There's no, it's a straight line, right? So you're just assuming. It's also an unstated major premise, which is that they're assuming a linear relationship between the whatever positive effect they're going for and dose, and that line never changes, right? But in reality, most things don't work that way, especially if you're talking about dosing anything that you would eat or anything, either food or pharmacologically. Yeah, having a little water is great. Too little water is very bad. Too much water, that's also really bad. It's not like the more water you drink, the better, without limit. So there's a false assumption in there. It's a non sequitur, and there's a little bit of a hasty generalization in that they're generalizing from a narrow, one small part of that line. They're extrapolating to the entire line rather than considering the possibility that there might be, you might exceed some threshold where it's not better. Either you could either reach a maximal effect, right? So there's plateau. Things can plateau, right? And this happens with drugs too. Like some, not all drugs, their effect doesn't necessarily continue forever. You can sometimes get a peak effect, and where increasing the dose does not improve the beneficial effect at all. So like the NSAIDs work this way, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen. You get to a certain maximum dose of ibuprofen, and then that's the maximum beneficial effect you're going to get from that drug. Increasing the dose does not have a further increased effect. Mm. You only get increased side effects. So
that's because of absorption, Steve?
No, it's because you've sort of maxed out that pharmacological effect that is the beneficial effect that we're going for. So you have to know what's physiologically happening in the body, right? Sometimes there's only so much of something that you could do. There's only so many receptors to bind to, or you've completely blocked something from happening. You can't block it beyond completely, you know? So the limit
of
that.
So then all you do is get a hole in your intestine.
Yeah, then all you do is get more side effects, right?
Yeah.
But like morphine does not have that. The effects just, there's no limit until you're dead.
Until you
right?
die. And, yeah, exactly.
You just keep getting more and more and more of an effect. So it's called a ceiling effect. So anyway, there's all different kinds of relationships that things can have. You could be a ceiling effect. You could have an overdose effect, a toxicity effect.
There's like bimodal things that happen, trimodal
right.
things
exactly.
that happen.
Exactly. So it's not, you can't just assume a linear effect of goodness for everything. So that's the major unstated premise there. Mm. But you're also generalizing from one narrow part of the curve to the whole curve. That's, I think, the most common example of that fallacy, whatever we're going to say that fallacy is vitamins, right? People think, vitamins are good for you, so more vitamins are better, and mega doses.
Yeah,
have
so 9,000%
awesome.
Is going to be healthy,
right? Yeah. But vitamins have toxicity too, you know.
Yeah, you're lucky if you just pee it all out.
Right. Yes, right. Exactly. Sure. All right. Thanks, Bill. That was a good one. Just for emails this week, just a couple of corrections. The first is a quick one. I was talking about, remember the densified wood a couple of weeks ago where they compost
the
wood?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, the cellulose.
So, yeah, right. So when
we got a lot of emails on that.
The wood get, part of the strength of the wood is they get hydrogen bonds between the structural component. Now, I just misspoke. I know that wood has cellulose, and that was all over the paper that I was reading, but I just brain fart. I said collagen. Collagen is a protein that's a major structural protein in animals. Cellulose is a complex carbohydrate that is a major structural component of plants. And chitin, since we're talking about structural proteins, chitin is also a carbohydrate that is a major structural component of insects
and
arthropods.
Right? Or, I'm sorry, fungus. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, because it's in the cell wall of the fungus.
Yeah, and it's a chitin is, what's a, an acetylglucosamine. And acetylglucosamine. Yeah, so it's a carbohydrate. So that, I just misspoke on that one. But yeah, plants have cellulose. And they also have lignin. That was the other major structural protein there. But they take the lignin out, and then they form the hydrogen bonds between the cellulose. The next one has to do correction. Next correction has to do with the analemma.
What did I do?
No, actually, I did this because when I do post production, I do fact checking, and something stood out for me when you were discussing the analemma that it was not what I remembered. It's not what I learned in astronomy class, and so I looked it up to see what the correct answer was. And the first reference I found confirmed what I remembered, but unfortunately it was wrong.
Interesting.
So, and part of it is that I didn't really fully understand what the answer was, and I literally spent like 3 hours looking, reading 20 different descriptions of the analemma to finally wrap my head around what the hell is going on. So you know, the analemma is the shape that that would be made if you took a picture of the sun in the sky at the same time every day for a year. So it's the shift in the position of the sun from day to day, you know, as it moves through the sky.
From a fixed position.
And it makes a lopsided figure eight. And the question is, what causes the different components of the movement of the sun? What I had learned in my astronomy class and what multiple references said, and unfortunately the first one that I saw, was that the eccentricity in the orbit is responsible for the back and the side-to-side movement, and that the tilt is responsible for the up and down movement, right? So if you eliminate the eccentricity, if the Earth was went around the sun in a perfect circle, the analemma would be an up and down line, right? Mm-hmm. So that's partly true, but it's not completely true. So let's break this down into a little bit more detail, Kara, than you went into, and because I did, I did wrap my head around this better, and I think this.
I did not spend 3 hours prepping.
No, it was it's hard. Most sites glossed over the actual explanation. It took me a long time to get to the site that actually had an explanation I could understand. Where they, you know, so here's, I think the easier one to understand is the eccentricity. So the fact that planets, you know, orbit the sun in an ellipse with the sun at one focus, not a perfect circle. So as the, you know, because of the eccentricity, the Earth is going a little bit faster when it's closer to the sun and then a little bit slower when it's farther away. So as it's going faster, then it shifts more each day. And so the loop in the figure eight is bigger, right? So in the northern hemisphere, the bottom half of the analemma has the bigger loop, because that's when the Earth is closer to the sun. Because in the northern hemisphere, we're closer to the sun during the winter, and we're farther from the sun during the summer. So in the upper part of the analemma, the circle is smaller because the Earth is moving a little bit slower. So it's not shifting as quickly from day to day. And it's flipped in the southern hemisphere. So, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the eccentricity is but the eccentricity is also, because it's moving faster and slower, the movement of the sun, when it's moving faster, it's sort of getting ahead of the average movement of the sun. And then when it's moving slower, it's falling behind, right? So you could think of the sun as sort of, it's farther, it'll be past the midway point at noon, you know, when the Earth is moving quicker, and then it falls behind the midway point when it's moving slower. And so that's the main component of the east to west, or the left to right shift, is due to the eccentricity. So that is still correct. It's the lopsidedness of the figure eight and the majority of the side to side movement. The axial tilt is responsible for the up and down movement. Why, you know, the sun is higher in the sky in the summer and lower in the sky during the winter, right?
Yes.
But here's the thing. The axial tilt also gives us a little bit of side-to-side movement. That's the thing I didn't know. And that is the thing that most sites aren't explicit about. It doesn't give you all of the side-to-side movement. It just gives you a little bit of side-to-side movement. And that's the thing I couldn't nail down for a long time, until at one site, the analemma.com, you know, ironically enough.
Of course.
You know, has a page where it
everything
goes,
you need to know.
It really is. So think about it this way, because of the tilt of the Earth, you know, the 23.5 degree tilt of the axis, the path of the sun is not going straight across, you know, the equator. It's going at an angle, so it's climbing up and then going down. So you could think about it as all of the movement isn't going across the longitudinals. Some of it it has a longer path to take, so it takes longer to get to any given longitudinal, so it falls a little bit behind. Does that make sense? It's hard to do this without pictures. If you look at the pictures, you'll see it's obvious. And then it catches up. This is even really less intuitive. It catches up when it's moving across the higher latitudes. The longitude lines are closer together, so it gets to the longitude quicker.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really hard to visualize. You really have to look at you have to think about it in terms of the celestial sphere, which is basically the projection of the longitude and latitude lines on the sky, and where the sun would appear if you're looking at where the sun is towards the Earth, or if you're looking out from the Earth. And it does make sense. You say, oh yeah, it's taking a longer path. It'd be falling behind. So at noon, it's not going to quite be there. And then, you know, when it's in the higher latitudes, it's going to be crossing those longitude lines. They're closer together, so it'll make up for lost time, and then it gets a little bit ahead. And so over the course of the year, you know, it's going to shift a little bit back and forth. And because there's no difference in how fast the Earth is moving in a perfect circle, it would be a perfect but very skinny figure eight. So there's a couple more interesting facts I don't think we mentioned. If you're in the North Pole, you would only see the upper half of the analemma. The lower half is entirely below the horizon.
Okay.
Right? And the South Pole is the same. It's the flipped, right? You only see the other half of the analemma, which makes sense.
And at the equator?
Here's something I found. At the equator, it depends on your perspective, right? Whether you think it's side to side or up and down. It depends on which way you're pointing yourself. Huh. But it's basically right overhead, right? The analemma would be going, it'd be it's the same shape, but it'll be directly overhead.
Would the figure eight still be lopsided, or would it be more of a...
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So, still be lopsided. The whole thing. Yeah, the whole thing. And the zenith would be, the crossover point. So here's something else that I never even considered. And how does the analemma change depending on what time of day you take your picture? Right. So if you take the picture at 8 o'clock in the morning versus noon versus 4 in the afternoon, what do you guys think?
Pulled to one side, I thought. Pulled to one side or the other?
It's tilted. So
it tilts. Right. Okay.
So it's like
it's kind of like as the moon sort of tilts as it goes across the night sky.
Yeah.
It goes through this tilting motion.
So it's straight up and down at noon. Tilted to the left in the morning and tilted to the right in the afternoon, in the northern hemisphere at least. Isn't that cool?
That is cool.
It's so hard to picture this.
It really
in
is.
Your head,
somebody created an analemma, multiple analemmas in one calendar year, right? So, like he's in Athens, Greece, with the same location, and he took pictures like at 10 a.m., at noon, at 5 p.m. and then at different times. So you have basically the same analemma, but at different times of day, and you can see how it just tilts. It's cool. Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard to wrap your head intuitively around why that everything would happen. The easy part for me is the tilt of the axis is mainly the up and down movement. The eccentricity is most of the side to side movement. The less intuitive thing was the tilt would also give you a little bit of side to side. And then the time of day thing I didn't even think about until I saw those pictures, which is interesting. Guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You have a theme this week.
Ooh.
How much do you guys know about water?
Wow. I know some things about water, but not all the things.
Wet.
Hydrogen, oxygen.
All right, well, let's see.
More hydrogen.
Here we go. Item number one. Water is paramagnetic, which means it is attracted to a magnetic field. Item number two, about 6,800 gallons of water is required to grow a day's food for a family of four. And item number three, water will dissolve more substances than sulfuric acid. Bob, go first.
Paramagnetic. Oh, I used to know what that means. I'm just going to go with that one. It sounds about right. Damn it. 6,800 gallons to grow a day's food for a family of four. Oof.
Depending on what kind of food, of course, but, average. Average, like American diet.
Damn, 6,800. Oh, that could be just either okay or wildly insane. And I don't know. I'm just, for some reason, I have a problem with three. This water will dissolve more substances than sulfuric acid. I'm calling bullshit on that one. I'll say the acid one's fake.
Okay. Jay?
Water is paramagnetic, attracted to a magnetic field. See, right out of the gate, like, wouldn't we be seeing the ocean do some weird shit if it was being affected by a magnetic field, since the Earth is, you know, like, has a gigantic magnetic field? I don't think water's magnetic or has any interaction with magnetism, but I don't know. 6,800 gallons of water required to grow a day's food for a family of four? Sure. If you think about, like, you know, averaging out between proteins and things like that, and especially if you're eating almonds. But 6,800 gallons, I mean, it sounds like a lot, but when you think about through the course of the lifetime of all the plants and all the water it takes to raise farm animals and things like that, I could see that. I mean, it's not wasting 6,800 gallons of water, just that's about how much water it takes to pass through that system in order to create those calories, sure. Water, and the third one, water will dissolve more substances than sulfuric acid. Well, I guess time is a factor here, and how, and if the water's moving, I think would be a huge factor. Since there's nothing in here about either of those dimensions, I'm going to just assume that since they're not in here, I could say, yes, over time, I think water could dissolve more than sulfuric acid. I don't think water has any interaction with magnetic fields. So I'm going to say the first one's a fake.
Okay, Evan.
I seem to remember an experiment a long time ago in a science class in which we did talk about the magnetic properties of water. I don't recall the term paramagnetic, but I'm kind of with Bob in thinking that there's some echo of truth here. And then 6,800 gallons of water required to grow the day's food. Jay made very good points. I think he's going to turn out to be right on that one. I'll go with Bob, and I'll say that the water dissolving more substances than sulfuric acid is incorrect in that, yes, Jay, it's a function of time, but I think it has more to do with the actual variance of the types of substances, and sulfuric acid will be the champion in that fight. So that's why I think that one's fiction.
And Kara.
It's so tough because I feel like the way that the final one is worded is so vague. Water will dissolve more substances than sulfuric acid. Does that mean if we added up all of the different compounds that exist in, you know, on the planet, and we sorted them into columns, is water a solvent for this compound? Is sulfuric acid a solvent for this compound? That the list under water would be longer than the list under sulfuric acid?
Correct. That's what that says.
Okay. And water is the universal solvent. Like, by definition, chemically, like, water dissolves things. That's what it does. It's the main solvent in almost everything. But sulfuric acid is quite strong. This one's tough because, I don't know, I'm going to go out on a limb, but this screwed me last time when I did this. Maybe 68,000 gallons is not right. Also, you didn't say, I'm assuming you mean a family of four in America because we eat a hell of a lot more awful food than in, you know, developing countries.
Those big Macs don't grow without water.
Yeah, so that's like
average diet for an American, yeah.
Average diet for American, which means it's going to include meat, but I don't know if an average American family only eats beef all day, every day. And something tells me that that number is more descriptive of if there was a very beef-heavy diet than if it was a mostly plant-based diet. The average American probably doesn't eat mostly plants, but they eat things like chicken and fish, which actually take less water. Obviously, plants take the least amount of water. So I don't know. I want to say that water is a little bit magnetic. I want to say that water, as the universal solvent, dissolves more stuff than sulfuric acid. I'm thinking maybe 6,800. It's probably like 680 gallons of water. I don't know. I'm probably wrong, but I'm going to go out on a limb and go with 68 gallons is wrong.
All right. So you guys are spread out over all three. That's always nice. It means I balanced them well. Let's see. Where shall we begin then? Why don't we take these in reverse order? Water will dissolve more substances than sulfuric acid. Bob and Evan, you think this one is the fiction.
Not anymore.
Jay and Kara, you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Ah, yeah.
Kara is correct. Water is the universal solvent. It dissolves,
I forgot about that.
Yay, chemistry.
It dissolves more substances than anything else. So I could have put anything after the van,
water in my
and
stomach.
It would have been correct.
Not exactly eating away my stomach.
So sulfuric acid is strong in terms of eating away at stuff, but yeah, in terms of the number of things that will dissolve in it, so water wins. Universal solvent.
Yeah, water can't dissolve lipids, but like almost everything else, it dissolves.
Right, things that are not aquaphobic.
Yes,
or hydrophobic.
Hydrophobic.
I like aquaphobic better.
I like aquaphobic
better.
Like a
superhero. Yeah.
I'm an aquaphobic man. So, yeah, Jay, I think you were thinking of erosion or something. I don't know. Just making like how much time it takes. I don't know what you were getting at there.
That reminds me of one of the coolest words, superhydrophobicity.
Yeah, that's cool.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but you think about the amount of time moving water has more power than standing water.
Erosion, not dissolving. All right, anyway. Let's go to number two. About 6,800 gallons of water is required to grow a day's food for a family of four. Carrie, you think this one is the fiction. The guys think this one is science. And this one is science.
Really?
Sorry, Carrie. Yeah, this one is science.
Crap.
So I had to vet this one carefully because, you know.
That's depressing.
It's a big number, 6,800. But yeah, the multiple sites give lots of supporting numbers for that. Yeah, it just takes a crap load of water to create to food. I mean, the whole cycle of you know, think about how many times you water a field of plants, and it's not
yeah,
just
but
directly,
especially animals.
It's the whole
food,
cycle.
They eat
yeah,
plants.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? All right, so there's different lists. You know, on one list here, the top of the list is actually chocolate.
Oh, uh-huh. Okay.
To make really? 1 kilogram of chocolate, it takes 17,000 liters of water.
What the hell?
Beef is 15,000 per kilogram. 15,000.
Yeah, beef is bad. I think almonds are pretty water intensive for a plant.
For plants, coffee requires 10 times as much water as tea. So if you want to preserve water, you could switch over to tea.
Not going to happen.
Yeah, bananas take 790 liters per kilogram. So even plants, it's a lot. So pizza, guys, 1,239 liters per unit of pizza. What's a unit of pizza?
Are we talking about
a whole pizza?
Talking about an extra a large with meatballs? I mean, what are we talking about? Bread is pretty intensive, 1,600 liters per kilogram. Pasta, 1,800. That's dry. I guess that's before you cook it. So, yeah. Also, chickpeas are very water intensive. And lentils.
Oh, that sucks. Because we eat those all over the world. Yeah.
Yeah, they're almost.
Did you read about almonds?
I was under the impression because, you know, we grow a lot of them in California where there's a drought and they're like, I was under the impression at least that they're incredibly water intensive, which is why I switched from almond milk to cashew milk.
100 grams of almonds, 150 liters of water. So it is of the plants on the list, it is pretty high. Rice is higher though, 500.
Yeah.
100 grams to 500 liters. So that would be 5,000 per kilogram and 1,500 per kilogram for almonds.
Maybe I can go back to my almond milk. I do like it. It tastes good.
That's what I hear.
All of this means that water is paramagnetic, which means it is attracted to a magnetic field, is the fiction. Although Jay was correct for the wrong reason, because water is diamagnetic, which means that it's repulsed by a magnetic field. So Evan and Bob, I got you guys exactly the way I was hoping I was going to get you. Like, I vaguely remember it's some kind of magnetic thing, you know. But
I saw the video in my mind of the stream bending.
Yeah,
next
but
to,
it's repulsed.
But it's repulsed, yep.
Yeah, and it's diamagnetic. Bastard. Pretty much everything is diamagnetic. Unless you're paramagnetic or ferromagnetic, everything else is diamagnetic, which means it's repulsed by a magnetic field because the magnetic field will induce little...
Ferromagnetic's like a real like it's a magnet.
No, that's a ferromagnetic. So ferromagnetic means you can hold a magnetic field. Right?
Yeah. Okay.
Paramagnetic means a magnetic field can be induced in you, but you can't hold on to one without an external magnetic field. And then diamagnetic means that there's these like these little vortices in the electron, whatever field is generated, and that creates a little bit of a repulsive magnetic field, but it's really teeny tiny. You have to use a strong magnet to get any kind of effect on water. But that's why, by the way, powerful magnets will levitate stuff because of the diamagnetic repulsion, including, Bob, frogs, right? Frogs are mostly water. Yeah. And it's the water in the frog that, or the mouse or whatever, that is diamagnetic and is being repulsed by the magnetic field.
Yeah, it's really cool.
So if you thought of levitation, that would have given you the answer to this one. Yeah, that was a little bit tricky.
Yeah.
So, but they, stuff about water. Who knew water was so complicated? There's so many things. I mean, this was just, there were so many things I could have included in this one. This is a bottomless pit
just
of interesting tidbits.
Drop in the bucket.
Yes,
nice, dude. It's an amazing substance. It's really, we'd be kind of screwed without it.
Well,
we'd be completely screwed without it.
Kind of water-based biology, yeah.
I wonder how much life would be screwed without it. Just life in general.
So far, it seems like pretty screwed. Water?
Intelligent life, well.
We don't know yet.
Yeah. Mm. We don't know of any life that can exist
without
water.
That's just it. We don't know.
Yep.
That would be exotic. Any life independent. It obviously wouldn't be carbon-based, I would imagine. Nope. We don't know. Silicon-based life, right?
The here we go. Every time the word carbon-based life comes up, the
hydrogen-based. Some kind of hydrogen breathers? I don't know. All right, Evan, do you have a quote for this week?
It is absolutely essential that one should be neutral and not fall in love with the hypothesis. And that was coined by David Douglas. David Douglas is an American physicist at the University of Rochester. He's also a fellow of the American Physical Society and the New York Academy of Sciences. And he has some pretty darn good quotes online, which you can look up. And I think he drives home a very important point here. Great to have all sorts of hypotheses on all sorts of things, but do not marry them. Because guess what? Especially if they turn out to not be correct, you're going to go down hard clinging on to something that's not right.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of basic, though. You know, a lot of people have said the similar thing, similar sentiments. Even, I think, Sherlock Holmes, right, expressed that same sentiment himself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but after 600 some odd episodes, you know, we're kind of scraping the barrel here, Steve. Come on.
All right, but here's my favorite quote about not being in love with your hypothesis or theories was by T.H. Huxley. But that's a beautiful theory slain by an ugly little fact.
Yeah.
So poetic.
Yeah.
Yes. Right?
Facts rule. You know, your theories and hypotheses are temporary things that you cannot cling to tightly. Because the more you tighten your grip, the more theories will slip through your fingers. Right, Jay?
A modified quote by Stephen Novello based on an original quote by Princess Leia Organa.
Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Surely.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.